Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. First of all, I'd like to welcome you to our program and also hope that you're having a safe and happy holiday. Today's program is devoted to the tens of millions, in fact, in America, hundreds of millions, of working class individuals. This is an ode to you because those in power are frequently using your lack of power against you. But how did this happen? When did the middle class no longer become relevant to being the cement that holds a society together, the foundation upon which many of us learn morals, manner, character development, meritocracy, care for our family, our friends, our society, where empathy and understanding the human condition were just a part of normal conditioning? How do we get here? I'm going to play a series of clips for today's program. You could agree or disagree with anything that is said, but all of it resonates true, and these are voices who care about you. These are not corporatists, these are not neoliberals, these are not people who want to manipulate you in any way. They just want to tell you the truth of what's happening. Identity politics, critical race theory, wokeism has infiltrated every aspect of our lives and really been devastating to many people within the middle class. There was a time when we had 70% of the population were middle class, working people. Not today. And the divide between rich and poor has just only increased, and it's all to one side's advantage, the rich and powerful, not to us. So we're first up is going to be Professor Hansen, Victor David Hansen, about the history of this whole movement and why we should pay attention to those who are deconstructing it, challenging it, or trying to tear us under. The second clip is about why we can't afford rent or even a home. And the third is from Neil Oliver, a historian, a really good philosopher. He's kind of like the Will Rogers of our modern day, talking about what's going on right now, why we can't trust the people in authority, and yet the middle class historically has always looked at those in power for direction, and they've been betrayed. Hopefully, less so after this special today. Now to our clips.
And this was the idea of diversity. Remember that affirmative action had been focused and targeted on the idea of the historical sin of slavery, and the idea that because people looked African, they were not fully American. In the United States during the Civil War, the efforts to stop Jim Crow, the Civil Rights Movement was trying to erase that blemish from its history. But under the idea of diversity, other groups that were not African American, not the 12% of the population, but other groups that were, quote, not white, were suddenly aggregated. And so the number of people that had claims on the majority for past grievances were anybody that was not white. And think what that entailed. You could emigrate from the Punjab and you could sell your farm for $200,000 an acre and be quite wealthy, arrive in California, and suddenly you were diverse. You would never experience discrimination in the United States, but you were diverse. Why were you diverse? For one reason. You were not white. At least you could claim you were not white. You could come from South America. You could be a Chilean aristocrat. You could come from Brazil. You could be a doctor from Nigeria. And all of a sudden, whatever your particular ethnic heritage was, you were beyond the old binary that white America was trying to come to grips with the prejudice shown and discrimination institutionalized against Native American people and black people. And so diversity said 30 to 33% of the population now doesn't feel part of America because we feel as non-white people that whiteness was toxic. Okay, notice what it does. It destroys entirely the concept of class. Remember what Marx said, the story of history is a binary. It's one of oppressors fighting oppressed, the exploiters fighting the exploited, the victimizers warring against the victimized. And it's all based on money and class and privilege. But when you apply that to the United States, it never really worked. Not with a huge middle class that was the basis of citizenship, not with the idea that race in the Constitution is not mentioned, it would be incidental, not essential to Americans, not anything. But all of a sudden, when you change class considerations and you say class doesn't matter and class is no longer synonymous with race, we could say maybe in the early 20th century still, or the 19th century, people who were not white or recent immigrants or their descendants from slaves economically faced greater obstacles. But today, for example, the highest income group by ethnic ancestry are Asian Americans. If you look at the fastest income gains of the last 20 years, they occur in Asian Americans and Hispanic Americans. And so what I'm getting at is race and class are not the same. And yet we're supposed to look at race now as victimizers. And so all of these anomalies appear. We're in this Orwellian world where Oprah Winfrey, from a $90 million home in Montecito, is talking to Meghan Markle from a $15 million home in Santa Barbara nearby. And what are they talking about? All of the injustice and the oppressions they've suffered as people with African-American ancestry. But their very status belies that fact. Or we have LeBron James, who's worth $1 billion, who tweets and he goes onto Facebook and says how unfair the United States is and how discriminatory it is. But remember, class and race are not identical anymore. And so I'm speaking from Hillsdale, Michigan, and when I ride my bike, I see some of the poorest people that I've ever seen in rural Michigan. They happen to be white. It's indifferent to me. But where I live, there are Mexican immigrants who are far wealthier in California. And yet we're going to back to a tribal identification that has nothing to do, in many cases, with victimization. And we're saying if you can posit a tribal identification, then the state or the government or the people owe you something. And this is headed for disaster. We know that from history that tribalism inevitably will end up like the former Yugoslavia or the strife we saw in Iraq or Rwanda. Out of that matrix, a lot of paradoxes and dilemmas arose, and they still challenge us today when we deal with citizenship. The first one was, should we all be equal in a polis or city-state, or should we all be free? Now, in America, we think equality is the same thing as freedom. But unfortunately, we're not born equally. I wish we were, but all of us have different health statuses. We have different energy levels. We have different talents. We have good luck, bad luck. Some of us die at 40. Some of us live to be 90. And that means that if you were farming in the ancient agrarian pre-industrial world, your parcel may get big and your neighbors may get small or non-existent. So the great philosophers of the Greek world, Plato, Aristotle, they thought, well, how can we create equality in perpetuity, because the middle class is the essential element of citizenship? And they discovered quite quickly you need a level of government coercion to force people who are more industrious or luckier or more talented not to be so industrious or talented, and you have to lift up the others. And in that process, you're curbing this, what would become a Latin word, liberty. And I think that's very important, because in our own age, we have to re-mind an old word, equity. We don't talk about equality of opportunity anymore, because that does not guarantee an equality result. So today, our old fight over liberty and equality is now a demand for equity. Equity means everybody should be equal on the back end. And the government then should deprive people of freedom and liberty so that all people can be equal. I think it was Tocqueville famously said, in a constitutional government, most people would rather be equal and poorer than all better off, but to see some a lot better off. That's innate to human nature, what Hesiod called jealousy and envy. Another dilemma of this new concept of citizenship was, it was evolutionary. And so as Plato very sarcastically said, who was a critic of democracy, well, at some point, even the dogs and the donkeys will want will want to be free, and they'll want to be able to vote. And Aristotle chipped in later and said, once a man votes equally with another man, then he feels that it's in his entitlement to be equal in all other aspects. And so citizenship says to us, well, if we're all going to vote, then why do we make less money than the other person? Or why does that person have a bigger house? And you can see that dilemma today, that equal voting permeates the society, and it creates this idea that just as we vote equally, we should have the same types of cars, we have the same types of jobs, we should have the same level of pay. The Greeks discovered that when you protect private property and you don't direct the economy and you unleash individual talent of the citizen, they make a lot of money. And the society gets affluent, and it's no longer day-to-day survival. And with affluence comes leisure, with leisure comes excess, and with excess comes what the Greeks thought was decadence. That means people didn't just wear leather clothing or cotton clothing, they would want purple clothing. And they just didn't want to eat lamb as a delicacy, but they might want to have quail eggs. And so there was this constant worry that the agrarian, hardworking citizen would be so successful and so affluent and so leisure, they would forget what was important in the world. And you can see that dilemma in Western civilization today as well. This system then was changed and modified by the Romans. As the Greek world was conquered by Rome, they picked and chose things they liked about citizenship and discarded things they didn't. And ironically, what was most important to the Romans were constitutions in the more conservative city-states, Sparta and Crete. And these systems were based on a distrust of power accumulating in too few hands and a distrust of what the average citizen could do anytime, anywhere, to anyone if there were no constitutional guardrails. And so Athenian democracy that executed Socrates or voted one day to kill the population on Mytilene and the next change their mind and send another trireme out to the island to reverse that decision, or executed the male members of Melians, frightened the Romans. So instead of having one executive consul, they had two. Instead of just having an assembly, they had a senate, but not just a regular senate. A senate, senex, is a good word for older people, older men who would be sober and judicious, and they wouldn't be so impulsive. And then they had tribal councils as what we would might call a lower house, but they had veto power, what the founders of our own country saw and liked, through tribunes. And then there were magistrates, executive branches. So the idea there was an executive, a legislative group, and judges all checking and balancing each other reflected this Roman idea that you had to be very careful about turning the reins of government over to the average person because it required a lot of time, a lot of maturity, and a lot of good judgment. And they felt that the Greek city-states that had been radically democratic lost that idea and were very reckless and self-destructive. The Roman Republic then lasted for over 700 years, the empire in the West for another 500 years. It's important at this point to remember the traditional critiques of citizenship. Citizenship never promised that it could change human nature. So slavery was with civilization from the beginning in the Near East. Indeed, there are places in North Africa and Asia and the Middle East where slavery still exists. In the ancient world, it was very hard to eradicate, unlike in the modern world, because it was not based on race. And by that I mean there was no idea that particular people deserved to be slaves because they were somehow naturally inferior. Think about that for a minute. If you were an Ethiopian, you could be a slave or you could be a master in Greece and Rome. Some of the emperors in the later empire that were themselves black, Terence the Great, comic poet and dramatist, comedian, was probably North African or more. I could go on, but you get the picture. If you're not invested in a pseudoscience of racial inferiority and you happen to be a slave, then you just say, well, I never said you were stupider than I am, the master. I just said you were more unlucky. Could happen to me tomorrow. I could be in the wrong city at the wrong place and be enslaved. And so, or I could lose money and they could put me into enslavement. And so it was an insidious institution that was very hard to eradicate. When people were in blocks, whether it was the helots in Sparta or slaves that were former gladiators, then they would revolt because they felt they had a collective ideology. But mostly slaves were detached in families, and there was no investment in the idea that the slave would be a slave because he was somehow inferior. In fact, most Roman families loved to have Greek slaves because they were better educated and more knowledgeable than their master. The second thing is very important to realize is, and this is more difficult and controversial, there was a concept going back to Greece that slavery permitted the individual to have the leisure and time to be an active citizen. That would mean walk 20 miles into Athens and get into the ecclesia or the assembly place out on the Pnyx and actually vote, and then walk back and serve maybe the next day on a jury, next day go to a comedy of Aristophanes, the next day go to a play to Aeschylus while somebody was making shoes or making pots in your little shop. Whether that's true or not, scholars disagree, but there does seem to be some idea, and this carried into the Confederacy, that constitutional government was time-consuming, and it required refinement and thinking, and therefore the more brutal and muscular arts should be devoted to slavery. I want to say another thing about race and citizenship. While this is going on in the southern Mediterranean, this idea of citizenship, and it is a rejection of the monumental civilizations in the Near East and in Crete and in Egypt in the sense that they were top down and this is broad and middle class. What's going on in so-called white Northern Europe, places that we now call Germany or France or Belgium or Scandinavia? In the ancient world, they were Germania or Gaul or Hispania. And the answer is not much. They were tribal, much like the American West, and in the pre-Columbian periods where very few people, maybe one or two per 100 square miles, tribal groups of the Huns, the Goths, the Ostgoths, the Vandals, they had no settled cities, no settled agriculture, very primitive. And Mediterranean peoples then equated these white tribes, blue-eyed, blonde hair, with savagery. It's quite ironic when people today allege that citizenship is the equivalent of race. It never has been.
Having a safe and affordable home is essential for all Americans to thrive. For decades, low-income families have struggled to access affordable rental homes. However, this issue has now become a significant problem for the middle class as well. Millions of middle-income earners are unable to afford rent in major U.S. cities due to the steep rise in prices since the pandemic. Without significant pay increases or government assistance, these middle-class households are being excluded from the typical middle-class neighborhoods. This exclusion triggers a chain reaction that leads to systemic poverty and lingering inequality. In other words, housing costs are suffocating the middle class. We have compiled several statistics and facts that demonstrate this trend. However, before we move on, we kindly request that you support our work and don't forget to subscribe to our channel so that you don't miss our upcoming videos. The American dream used to entail getting married, settling down, purchasing a home, and growing old. However, in today's world, this concept looks vastly different. Buying a home is no longer an affordable option for everyone. Multiple financial burdens have emerged for everyday Americans, such as increased debt, soaring housing costs, and rampant inflation. These factors have contributed to the decline in homeownership and the shift towards renting. Currently, almost 43 million families live in rented apartments in America, which is the highest level in history. The surge in the number of middle-class renters has been staggering. In the past 5 years, the number of households making from $56,000 to $100,000 a year that decided to rent increased by 82%, according to a recent report from the Joint Center for Housing Studies of Harvard University. At the same time, rental vacancy rates are lower than they've been since 1985, and once renters do find housing, they have to pay the price. The typical home now costs about $80,000 more than it did just 2 years ago, and the average rent in the U.S. is over $1,000 more expensive than it was in 2020. Rents are now climbing an average of 3.5% annually, while middle-class renters' incomes have declined 9% over the past decade. In an interview with ABC, salesman Robert Gary from Columbus, Ohio, said he always lived a comfortable middle-class life until the pandemic changed everything. Now Gary is seeing his pay rise fail in comparison to the rise in cost of living. I'm living paycheck to paycheck and barely making it, he said. I get a raise, they raise the prices to take my raise away. According to Gary, in December, his landlord informed him that his rent would increase from $1,710 a month to $1,950 a month starting January 2023. A $240 increase in a month was just insane stress, Gary said. No one cares anymore. Companies are out there taking as much as they can get. When asked if he could afford it, the renter lamented, "No. Not with the price of everything else right now. I mean, that's half my income." The only things he could find cheaper than this were in neighborhoods that he wouldn't feel safe in. The pace at which Gary was forced out of his middle-class lifestyle was extremely shocking to him. "It is unlike anything I have seen in my 60 years in America," he emphasized, adding that he now has to move out and stay with a friend until he can find a place he can afford. Unfortunately, similar situations are increasingly common for middle-income renters. In fact, the managing director of the Joint Center of Housing Studies, JCHS, Chris Herbert, argues that in 2023, rental housing in America is a tale of two markets. While higher-income renters are finding a healthier supply of housing choices, too many families earning less than $100,000 per year are having to make trade-offs between putting a roof over their heads and food on the table. In most metropolitan areas across the country, the American middle class has been spending far more on housing than they can afford, researchers found. A study highlights that 21.2% of middle-class homeowners and 46.3% of middle-class renters in the United States are either moderately or severely burdened by housing costs, defined as spending more than 30% or more than 50% of their income on housing, respectively. The property price boom of the past few years has pushed 70% of homes out of reach of first home buyers on middle incomes, especially now at the highest interest rates in over a decade. Those able to buy are having to save for an extra year to have a 20% deposit, the data revealed. Meanwhile, rents are consuming progressively larger shares of income. In Boston, for example, the median rent hit $2,680 in February, up 24% from 3 years ago. A household would need to earn at least $117,000 annually to afford this, based on the standard definition of affordability, in which one should pay no more than 30% of income for housing. Consider that in Boston, an elementary school teacher makes approximately $68,000 a year, and a registered nurse $73,000, and you get the picture that the middle class is getting squeezed. Median rents in Los Angeles are currently at $3,000, while in Washington, they are $2,600 per month. The demand for rental housing is high due to an exploding population of millennials burdened with student loans and low-paying jobs, baby boomer retirees downsizing to apartments, former homeowners exiting foreclosure, and millions of Ward B homeowners who cannot access mortgages in the tight credit market. Everyone wants the same type of location, which includes cities, transit-friendly suburbs, and town centers that are walkable and close to jobs. However, the pace of new residential construction has been insufficient to make up for years of virtual standstill. In many cities, demand is so high that there are enough high-income renters to support prices that are out of reach for the middle class, lower-wage employees, and seniors. This supply and demand imbalance is expected to keep rents high for the foreseeable future. We are currently in a rental affordability crisis. 15 years ago, more than two-thirds of people who rented an apartment or a single-family home in the U.S. earned less than $30,000 a year. However, beginning in 2010, the share of middle-class renters surged as the country started to heal from the 2008 housing bust. This shift came as the economy drove up home prices to new record highs, straining family budgets across the country. Rents, too, have been rising since the Great Recession, and in coastal and hot cities like Denver and Austin, these increases have put even rentals out of reach for most of the middle class. In 2022, the capital required to sign a lease on an average price $3,500 per month apartment in San Francisco often exceeds $12,000 due to requirements for first and last month's rent, security deposits, and a broker fee. In contrast, since 2010, there has been a significant increase in home building that could make up for the time when it virtually stopped all over the nation. "We didn't build anything in the recession that's still biting us today," said Andre Bueno, the founder of Los Angeles-based real estate investment firm Bueno Group. "If you are in the missing middle, you are incredibly out of luck. The missing middle represents those who aren't rich enough to navigate the current housing market without getting burned, and at the same time aren't poor enough to qualify for government assistance on housing. It's no wonder that U.S. cities are increasingly home to high rollers who can pay high rents or down payments and lower-income people who qualify for subsidized housing, while middle-income earners are being priced out of middle-income neighborhoods. Every passing year makes it harder for middle-class renters who cannot qualify for subsidized housing to find affordable apartments on the market. Renters need to earn $21.21 per hour to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment in the U.S. According to the National Low-Income Housing Council, significantly more than the average national hourly wage of $16.38. This is why 51% of renters in the middle class are unable to afford a place to live in most U.S. cities. The past few years have seen the disappearance of the savings that were once associated with the middle class, as wage growth has stagnated. This not only makes it difficult for people to remain in the middle class, but also makes it impossible to come up with the high sums required to rent or buy city apartments. According to Michael Dickerson, a housing expert at the University of Texas, the affordable housing crisis is not just for the very poor, but also for those with good jobs who are not poor enough to qualify for subsidized housing and not rich enough to pay the rising housing prices. For instance, a family making $100,000 a year cannot afford to buy a house in most U.S. cities. Analysis at the University of Texas estimate that to comfortably raise a middle-class family, one needs to make around $300,000 a year. Due to rising cost of gasoline, food, housing, travel, tuition, and healthcare, the middle-class lifestyle is becoming increasingly difficult to achieve. Even though it is statistically possible to raise a family with less income, it won't be easy if one's goal is to save for retirement, save for their child's education, own a home, and retire at a reasonable age. Managing everyday expenses has become increasingly challenging for many Americans, especially those with lower incomes. Spending too much on rent can have far-reaching implications that go beyond the end of the month's stress. According to a study by Apartment List, households across the U.S. spend 41% less on food and 71% less on healthcare due to the cost burden of housing. Already, approximately 51 million households do not earn enough to afford a monthly budget that includes housing, food, childcare, healthcare, transportation, and a cell phone. The majority of people are struggling with housing, according to Fannie Mae Maury Family Research head Kim Betancourt, who notes that there is not enough affordable housing for the people who need it. This creates a chain reaction where a middle-class person occupies an apartment that a lower-income person might have occupied, and so on. If there are not enough cheaper options, it leads to systemic poverty and an increasingly unequal America where only those at the very top of the economic chain can own their own homes and build equity through properties while the middle class is hollowed out. This is not just a housing and rental crisis, but a reflection of the crumbling foundations of a broken society, and nothing that our leaders are doing is making things any better. The financial meltdown that we are witnessing today is a reminder that more distress is coming for everyday Americans.
I don't think I can overlook the ULEZ scheme in London, which is to say the ultra-low emissions zone, which is pitched as a way to improve the quality of air in London. But as is demonstrably the case, it's a power grab and a money grab. It's a tax by a latter-day highway robber, a 21st century Dick Turpin. You know, we hanged Dick Turpin for highway robbery, but highway robbery is back again. And it's, you know, for people out with the United Kingdom, it's not just in London. It's going to be rolled out eventually in every town and city in Britain. And I'm sure the same thing is happening all over the Western world. We're being told that it's all about saving children's lungs by improving air quality, but it's nothing to do with that. As always, the issue is not the issue. It's never about what they say it's about. It's an excuse to tax people to further impoverish and immiserate the people, the middle class, and to sneak in yet more surveillance. It's an excuse for another phalanx of cameras to keep an eye on everybody's movements and watch number plates on cars and all the rest of it. You know what it is? The powerful are at war with the people. And the powerful have been at war with the people for years. And I say right at the front, right at the top, I find it humiliating and embarrassing when I realise and accept how long I overlooked the blatant evidence of that war being waged. It's a war. They're at war with us. The powerful are at war with the people. It's a cold war. You know, it hasn't come to, it hasn't really come to bullets and bayonets yet, but the clock's ticking. Watch this space. But in every way they can think of, the powerful are at work impoverishing the people. That's the form that it's taken. They're impoverishing those they have made all but helpless in the face of the tyranny. They have taken advantage of the law-abiding nature of the people. They have exploited the tendency of the majority of the law-abiding, tax-paying people to keep their heads down and not make waves. I would say the most significant battle at the moment is the offensive being waged blatantly against those who have worked all their lives towards building better lives for themselves and their families. It's becoming unavoidable. We can no longer ignore the fact that the presence of a middle class in Britain is no longer to be tolerated by those who would prefer dependency on the part of the people that they want to rule. Not govern, not serve, but rule. They'll stop at nothing until the middling class of the Western world is made poor and dependent upon the handouts of the ultra-rich and the politicians that the ultra-rich pay for and control. You know, it's so enraging. The powerful care not a jot for the health and well-being of the people. It's clear to see. Far better, as far as the powerful are concerned, if more and more people here in Britain and elsewhere in the West are made fat and sick and poor, and therefore more likely to welcome sinister offerings like universal basic income, which is an abomination waved in the face of a once proud and independent people. I think about this all the time. It's an anecdote. Years ago now, when I say years ago, it must be 15 years ago, at least, a friend of mine who at the time was working as a freelance sound recordist. You know, so this was somebody that I knew through work as a jobbing TV presenter. He landed at an airport in one of the southern states of the US. I can't remember which one. He got into a taxi. You know, he had arrived separate from the rest of the crew for whatever reason. He was getting himself a taxi to get dropped off wherever he was needed. And the taxi had no sooner sort of pulled towards the exit from the airport, but they hit a pedestrian crossing. And shambling across, the taxi had to stop, and shambling across the crossing was an enormous couple of people. Like morbidly obese, barely covering the reality of them. And my friend made some sort of remark within the hearing of the driver. And the driver turned around and looked at him and said, "Have you got half an hour?" My friend said, "Well, yes, why?" He said, "If you'll let me, I want to show you something." And so he knocked off the meter, stopped the meter ticking on the taxi, and he drove him into like a suburb of the city. And it was long, straight streets past sort of verandaed houses, you know, low income houses, but single story with a veranda out the front and old couches and deck chairs and things out the front, and people sitting on those. And they were all huge, all enormous people. And the driver turned to my friend and said, "They're turning us into battery hens, man. They just want us fat and sick and stupid." And they drove like that past house after house, street after street. And then he said, "Have you seen enough?" And my friend said, "Yeah, I get your point." The guy turned the meter back on and drove him to wherever it was he was supposed to be. I think about that all the time because he had noticed. He had noticed what was happening to the people around him. That's just an anecdote, as I say. In spite of the evident erosion of health and well-being, which is driven deliberately by toxic food and unhealthy lifestyles that are all but foisted upon us. The people are being encouraged to be unwell. Don't worry about it. Eat what you like. Get as big as you like. Big Pharma will come up with a pill or an injection that'll deal with that. Don't take responsibility for your own well-being. Don't bother going to the gym. Go to a fast food outlet instead. And they want people dependent. The intention is to make the population dependent on the products of Big Pharma, because that's the bottom line, the big fat bottom line. And even now, here at home, the powerful use health as a pretext. In the face of that, they use health as a wholly fictional pretext for further eroding the UK population's freedom and privacy. The powerful, the government, the state, the establishment, they don't care about the health and well-being of the people. It throughout lockdown and the rest of it, it was gyms that were closed and parks that were closed and fast food outlets that were open. It's not about taking care of the health and well-being of the people. The erosion, the evident erosion of health and well-being is plain to see. It's driven by toxic food, frankly. Vegetable oils, seed oils, sugar and everything. The promotion of unhealthy lifestyles. Get as big and fat as you like and Big Pharma will come forward with a pill or a potion or an injection to take care of those consequences. God forbid people should be responsible for their own health and well-being. But even in the face of all that, there's this pretext of health as the motivating factor for new legislation. It's a wholly fictional pretext. And all it does is further erode the UK population's freedom and privacy. And by further stealth, brings in more surveillance, more cameras, this time recognising number plates and the rest of it. But it's just to demoralise people and get them more and more accustomed to being watched 24 hours a day as they go about their lives. And, you know, here in the UK for weeks, certainly for days, the headlines in the mainstream media have been about the launch of the ULEZ, the Ultra Low Emissions Zone in London, which has now been extended to cover the whole of London. So it's right out into the rural area, out into the fringes where air pollution monitors show figures like 2.5% in terms of air pollution, when any figure below 10% is good quality air. You know, when everyone knows that if it was anything to do with health, that the London Underground would probably be shut until further notice because of the figures down there, into which people are herded because they're discouraged from using their cars or any other private transport, and they're herded down into those toxic zones. So if it was actually anything to do with people's health, it would all be being handled very differently. You know, and the mere fact is that if it was about the health, it's always about Sadiq Khan talking about asthmatic children and people dying, children dying because of the air they're breathing. And if it was actually motivated by saving children's lives, then he would simply say all cars of a certain characteristic are banned. But he doesn't. If it's all about air pollution and the quality of the air being breathed by children, but apparently for £12.50 you can pump out as much pollution as you like. So it's a nonsense to say it's anything to do with health. It's about money. It's about another taxation on people. And it's also about more control. The London Evening Standard, which is like, if you walk through London of an afternoon, that's the paper that appears on the newsstands that updates Londoners. And their headline is Gotcha. It's a big picture of a ULEZ camera pointed at the reader. And it says, Gotcha. London's green dream comes alive. Day one of a brave new world. For our great capital. Brave new world. I mean, where have we heard that before? And this nonsense, it being about health. You know, the TfL, the Transport for London's own report, conceded that the impact of the ULEZ scheme so far, in as much as it's already been operating in a more centralised part of the city, has had negligible impact on air quality. It hasn't done anything that any worthwhile machine can measure, right? So it's just a money grab. More surveillance, more taxation. And that idea of, you know, everything we're told is about saving the planet, you know, making the Earth greener, making the planet a healthier little ball hurtling through space. Everywhere you look, you see the nonsense of that, the insincerity of that, the lie of that. The Nord Stream pipeline from Russia into Europe via Germany was blown up by the Biden administration. The Joe Biden US White House sanctioned the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. That was an act of war against a NATO ally. That pipeline was blown up in the faces of the German people. Germany being the most powerful country in Europe, and Europe being the most significant ally that the US has left. It was nothing less than an attack on Germany's industrial capability. Its economy, full stop. When we know that it's cheap, accessible, reliable energy, and the prosperity that flows from such, that elevates people out of poverty. That's been the story throughout the 20th and into the 21st century. The destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline meant the greatest man-made release of CO2 in human history. I'll say that again. The greatest single man-made release of CO2 in human history. And they knew that would be the consequence of blowing up that pipeline. So evidently the US says to hell with worrying about CO2 released into the atmosphere. Everything is about control and dominance and the extension of both. And by the way, you know, for people closer to home who are aware of the political situation in Britain in a way perhaps that people in the wider world are not, pay no attention at all to Conservative Party protests about what Sadiq Khan, Mayor of London, has done. Yes, Khan sought to persuade scientists to rewrite the reports using language and data more favourable to his scheme. Yes, the TfL report, the Transport for London report, made plain that ULEZ hasn't worked. Yes, there are plans for a pay-by-mile scheme for cars in the future. No, it's not about health. And as I said before, if it was, London Underground would be a no-go zone until further notice. But make no mistake, the Tories, the Conservative Party, are just absolving themselves of responsibility. They're holding Labour's coat while Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, and his deputy, Angela Rayner, make no secret whatever that they plan to roll out ULEZ schemes to every town and city in Britain in the event of their forming a government in the aftermath of a next general election that they are broadly expected to win. But the Conservative Party, in the end, are every bit as committed as Labour to the suicide note of Agendas 21 and 30. You know, they're every bit as committed to the anti-human, frankly murderous lunacy of net zero for the world. The Conservatives and Labour are two shrivelled testicles hanging low in the same scrotum, juiceless and with no life left to give. They're just occupying a space. What is incoming is ever-increasing surveillance, 15-minute ghettos to live in, digital identification, central bank digital currencies to control how, what, when, and even if you spend your own money. Control, control, control. And to me, underlying all of this is tragedy. The tragedy is inevitable because people, decent, otherwise law-abiding people, who just want to go about the business of leading decent lives are being pushed inexorably into a corner. One by one, their options are being stripped from them. They see their living standards eroded day by day. They see the prospects for their children and grandchildren hopelessly diminished. And they're made to feel powerless in the face of it. And eventually, and here's the tragedy, unknown numbers of people will have nothing left to lose. And people with nothing to lose are unpredictable, to say the least. And what a tragedy in this law-abiding country of ours that so many will be left with no option but to take the law into their own hands. They're being pushed knowingly into that by the authorities, by the establishment. And what then, if and when civil obedience breaks out? I mean, the so-called Blade Runners are already out there. That's a team that are operating throughout London, disabling the ULEZ cameras. They're cutting the cables, or they're taking the cameras down completely, or they're spraying paint and whatever, insulation foam across the lenses just to knock them out of service. People are already acting in defiance. But what happens when that civil disobedience spreads? I don't know, a curfew for London, let's say, Let's imagine they just shut the place down from 6 o'clock in the evening till 6 o'clock in the morning. I don't know. What about curfews across the country? What happens when people have no alternative but to defy legislation in order to provide for their families? I've said it before and I'll say it again, but it's the obligation. It's not just the right or the responsibility. It's the obligation of lawful people to stand in defiance of unlawful government and unlawful legislation. You can't stand by, you know? The front page of the London Evening Standard has name-checked Aldous Huxley's grim prediction of the future in the form of Brave New World, his most famous work. But I see we are also looking at A War of the Worlds to name-check another. At this time, the invasion and threat comes not from Mars, but from the enemy within, which is the aforementioned powerful and their puppet governments here and around the world. That war, albeit a cold war, is being waged right now against our way of life. It's a war against our world. And at the end of the book, the technological monsters, the robots, have been undone and fallen, not because of anything man has been able to do in the face of it, but because of pathogens in the air. Ironically, they're brought down by bad air, as far as they're concerned. So the invaders die. But the last page of The War of the World is a wake-up call for the world. To quote, "that so much was so nearly lost has," says the narrator, "robbed us of that serene confidence in the future, which is the most fruitful source of decadence." How true. How unknowingly, unwittingly decadent we have been these decades past, while unseen by most of us, the powerful have moved to invade our world and take control of it. Perhaps it's that decadence that has kept us blind for so long about the activities of those who want power over us, total power. You know, I don't feel it's too extreme to make dire warning of what is imminent, what is happening, what has been inflicted and imposed and snuck in under the cover of democratic government. What a joke that is in this country. Look at what is happening. Today it's ULEZ. Tomorrow it will be something else. Until eventually, if they, the powerful, have their way, we will have nothing and we will be unhappy.
So, the Fed plans to destroy the middle class in order to make the rich richer. But before I explain why and exactly what you can do, you need to understand that this isn't the first time that this happened.
1980s, inflation was super high, so the Fed said, let's raise rates to stop spending and force the economy into a recession. Then President Reagan wanted to one-up the Fed to see who can screw over more people. So he cut social safety nets and gave tax cuts to the rich. And the result was surprisingly better than expected. Only half the incomes across the US fell, and only about 20% of the middle class went poof. All while the rich got richer. But it wasn't until the Great Recession that started the beginning of the end of the middle class. In 2008, the pattern repeats. The US economy collapses, the government gives billions to big banks to survive, despite being the ones that caused the problem. The labor, housing, and stock market tanks, leading to a 47% drop in median net worth and over 15% of Americans to fall below the poverty line, making middle class wealth go poof again. And since then, the wealth gap between the haves and the have-nots have reached the highest level ever recorded. But this isn't even the worst of it. You see, to save the economy, the Fed needs to make a hard choice. Sacrifice the rich or the poor through its economic policies. Inflation is currently the highest it's been since the 1980s, and the Fed decided to use the same exact plan to save the economy. Aggressively raise interest rates to tighten credit, force the economy into recession, and surprise, surprise, just like every other recession in the past, the middle class and the poor will bear most of the burden. But the scary part is, this time, it'll be far more brutal and miserable than ever before, because honestly, most of the middle class will not recover. Look, although the data shows that middle-income families did get wealthier the past few years, it didn't even come close to making up for the losses that they faced from the 2008 financial crisis. In contrast, upper-income families actually saw a 10% higher median net worth. And the terrifying part is the middle class is vanishing quicker than the value of Logan Paul's NFTs. Back in 1971, 61% of US adults belonged in the middle class. But as we go through time, that percentage falls to 52% in 2016. And now, even though the American middle class looks to be stabilizing right at the lower 50% range, the middle class continues to fall behind financially. 6 in 10 households do not have enough liquid assets to cover 3 months worth of expenses, which is bad news, because on average, recessions in the US last about 10 months. But let's stop being negative, Nancy, and look at the bigger picture. Maybe it'll paint a better story than the Twilight novels ever could, because the reality is, middle-class families have assets beyond just what's in their bank accounts, like their net worth. So about 30 years ago, the middle 60% of Americans had double the net worth of the 1%, which makes sense. The majority of citizens should collectively have more wealth than just a select few. But then something happened. The rigged system has been working as planned, and the rich have been strategically taking advantage of every economic crisis, leading to, for the very first time in US history in 2021, the top 1% now owns more wealth than the middle 60%. Let that sink in. And this comes at a time when 75% of middle-class households say their income is falling behind the cost of living. The wealth gap in the US has changed so much the past few decades that even Webster Dictionary can't agree on how to define the middle class. For many years, the term middle class referred to Americans who successfully reached a version of the American dream, a stable income, a house, and a sense of financial security for the future. But that's no longer the case. Now, the middle class refers to people who can set up automatic payments to pay off their credit card debt. But what might even be a more important criterion is whether a middle class American can still afford the three H's. And the scary truth is, the impending recession could be the final nail in the coffin that redefines the middle class forever. The first H, housing, and being able to afford a house was a key reality for the middle class just a few years ago. But now, owning a home is more unrealistic than the movie scenes where they cook enough breakfast for 97 people on a Tuesday and no one ends up eating it. Seriously, I woke up at 2 a.m. to make all of this and you only grab a pancake? Get your ass back here. And this is only expected to get worse. In 1970, the median annual income was $9,870. The median house cost about $17,000, so about 1.7 times the median annual income. In 2022, however, the median annual income is $65,000, while the median house costs $428,700, about 6.5 times the median annual income. And while it is supernatural for prices to rise over time, the issue is that home values significantly outpace inflation, making it nearly impossible for new and young buyers to enter the market, which poses two massive problems. First, in the short term, the majority of America, the middle class, are getting priced out and are forced to pay too damn high rent, which adds to their already too damn high expenses. Second, in the long term, the wealth gap will get higher than Charlie Sheen, because real estate is one of the fastest vehicles to grow wealth, and if only the rich can afford it, then the rich will get much richer faster. And all this is made much worse with the second H. About 40% of millennials who don't own homes say they can't afford one because of student loans, aka higher education. Look, it's no secret. Getting a higher education is now drastically more expensive, to the point that most students are forced to be riddled with debt just to get one, which is counterintuitive because an advanced society generally benefits from having an educated public. So we can avoid questions like this.
Is math related to science?
Average student loan debt in 1990 was about $18,000 adjusted for inflation, but by 2020, it doubled to $36,635, bringing the national student debt to over $1.7 trillion in 2020, when it was just $500 billion in 2006. And not surprisingly, the average American household income to debt ratio, basically how much you owe each month to how much you earn, is getting worse. In the 80s, the ratio hovered around 0.6, which meant that the middle class family making $100,000 has somewhere around $60,000 in debt. Now, that ratio is just under 1, meaning the same exact family will have around $100,000 in debt. And over the past decade, most of this debt is because of higher education, but that might change to the third H, when the recession hits. Healthcare is a tricky expense because although medical costs also increase faster than inflation over the past two decades, chances are if you are a middle-class American, then your employer provides health insurance, which makes it decently affordable. And for now, the job market is still relatively strong, so most of us are safe. However, the concern here is when the Fed successfully forces a recession from raising rates, then millions of Americans will get smacked harder than Chris Rock and lose their jobs. The IMF predicts unemployment may reach 7.5%, or roughly 6 million people will lose their jobs, essentially forcing all these people to shop for new, more expensive health insurance, putting them at risk of financial jeopardy. Middle-class America is in a very bad place. Two-thirds of Americans are digging into their savings just to pay for things. In 1985, the average major living expense for a family of four, including housing, healthcare, transportation, and education, was around $13,227. The typical male worker needed to work about 30 weeks to cover this cost. But in 2018, the average major living expense is now $54,441, and the average male worker has to work 53 weeks to afford this, and there are only 52 weeks in a year.
Thank you all for listening, and I hope that this gave you some insights into the human condition, and most importantly, let you know that, yeah, we're middle class, and we're going to stay middle class with ethics, common sense, reason, and a sense of purpose, even if those in power don't like it. Have a nice day, everyone.